Hey everyone, and welcome to the forum where science comes to socialize. I have with me my two lovely co-hosts, Aubrey and Cleo, and of course, you.
That's right. Get involved with us on social media. You can find us on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook by searching ISGP's The Forum.
You can send us your comments, questions, concerns. Heck, you can even send us pictures of your cat, but make sure you tag it with #ISGPForum.
Moving away from cat photos, today's topic is about applying what you think you know, and making it what you know, so other people can know what you know.
What?
That literally made no sense.
Okay, let me rephrase. Today is about applying our knowledge of past influenza pandemics to the current predictive models so that we can better understand and hence better combat emerging flu strains.
Much better.
Today's paper and the debate that went along with it came from the Institute on Science for Global Policy's Signature Series conference that took place from October 23rd to 26 in 2011, called Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases: Focus on Mitigation.
Shout out to episode 11, Cootie Catchers, which also comes from this conference.
And if you just love learning about the flu, check out our other episodes on the topic as well.
The paper in question today is titled It's Not What You Know, But What You Do With What You Know. It was written by Ilaria Capua, who is the director of the Division of Comparative Biomedical Sciences at the Istituto Zooprofilattico Sperimentale delle Venezie in Padova, Italy. And you are not allowed to judge my Italian.
I feel like you should be throwing Parmesan into the air. And I'm Italian, so I'm allowed to say that.
So, I guess the first question that comes to mind is, what do we know?
Well, we know that today we'll be talking about two specific flu strains, H1N1, or the swine flu, and H5N1, or the avian flu.
I seriously cannot hear the words avian flu without thinking of that terrible old school joke.
Which one?
There once was a bird named Enza. I opened a window and in flew Enza.
Ugh.
Ugh.
That is one of the worst puns I've heard in a while.
I'll make it up to you by moving on to a more serious note. Since the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, we have been acutely aware of how our prediction skills need to be improved on many fronts.
So what you're saying is that we know what we don't know.
Exactly. Dr. Capua actually said that scientists were caught off guard by the event. This is because most funding and research on pandemic flu was focused on different localities with different strains. Specifically, a lot of time and effort went into looking into Southeast Asia, which was deemed the viral epicenter of the world at that point, and because of this, scientists completely missed the emergence of swine flu from Central America.
To say that swine flu came completely out of left field sounds like an understatement.
It gets weirder than that, though, because scientists didn't even have H1N1 on their list of potentially pandemic flu strains. It was considered relatively mild and was underestimated due to the fact that it emerged from pigs rather than birds. So even if it had arisen in Asia, it probably would have been just as unexpected.
At the time, the general thought was that in order for a flu to go full-blown pandemic, it had to have a different subtype than those currently circulating among humans as seasonal strains. This, however, is not true, and it has proven to be quite the blind spot.
The debaters agreed with Dr. Capua about the inadequate state of H1N1 research prior to its pandemic outbreak. However, they said that at the time, H5N1, or avian flu, was considered a game changer, mostly because of all of the attention it garnered from financial donors and organizations. It was this attention that caused the blind spot for the swine flu, according to debaters.
In fact, the only correct prediction regarding H1N1 that researchers were able to make, according to Dr. Capua, was that it would spread rapidly due to globalization trends.
Quote, betting on the wrong virus resulted in general mistrust of international health organizations, which in turn affected public perception of international health policies aimed at preparedness and mitigation.
Understandable. If all the leading health experts told me to beware of one flu strain and then I got infected with another, I might question their trustworthiness as well. It's like the boy who cried wolf, only instead, when he cried wolf, a bear snuck up and got him instead.
So we certainly have a lot that we know we don't know, but is there anything we just know we know?
All of these no's are going to give me a headache.
Well,
Oh no, I'm sensing some more we don't know's coming.
we've seen big improvements in infrastructure and surveillance since the H5N1/H1N1 crisis, for sure. Thousands of strains with zoonotic potential have been collected. However, the genetic information has not been fully exploited. More in-depth knowledge could help identify the pandemic potential of strains and help with prevention and mitigation strategies.
It sounds like scientists need to team up and share their data, particularly those genetic sequences, to make this more effective.
Well,
You too? What don't we know this time?
actually, for once, I'm the bearer of good news. This time, it's what we do know. The debaters were very keen on discussing the topic of data sharing. They mentioned that many scientists have guarded their genetic sequences to protect the originality of their research for academic publishing. And it's not just their sequences either. Researchers are afraid that their data will be scooped up from underneath them and published before they even notice what's happened. Okay, so maybe I'm the bearer of good-ish news. We know something this time, but what we know isn't necessarily positive.
Aww. But isn't that the number one rule of preschool? Sharing is caring, my fellow scientists.
You couldn't be more right, Barb. However, there are more disincentives to sharing that we should mention. Some countries feared that they would create more damage than benefits when sharing their information. For example, at one point in time, Vietnam isolated a flu strain and shared it with the rest of the world. Were they rewarded for their efforts? Nope. They were made to purchase the vaccine that was made from the strain in the end.
Because of this, countries that do share their data don't do it solely out of the kindness of their hearts. Many now require signed agreements that list the benefits they'll receive if they share their data.
But there is a beacon of shining goodness in all of this. Due to the growing need of cooperation and data sharing in infectious disease control, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, or NIAID, and the NIH have been promoting data depositing into the public domain. And the WHO's Pandemic Influenza Preparedness Framework, or PIP, shares information on influenza viruses, vaccines, and other things.
And Dr. Capua definitely agreed with you that sharing is caring. Well, maybe just not in those words. She thought that full genome sequencing on influenza strains needs to be done, and it must be shared publicly. So there's at least one scientist on your side, Barb.
Not to rain on your parade, guys, but there were some critiques to open sharing of data among debaters as well.
Of course there were.
It's okay, Barb. It's not as bad as you think. Mostly, the debaters thought that sharing shouldn't just occur haphazardly, but rather that there should be set parameters regarding what does and what doesn't need to be shared.
This is because making all data publicly available could pose a biodefense threat.
Like someone launching the flu virus instead of airstrikes at a country?
Sort of like that. Except it'll most likely involve less actual throwing of vials than your examples make me envision.
Well, to avoid such events, the debaters suggested having levels of sharing, depending on how dangerous the knowledge is. Some levels could be publicly accessible, and some could require a password from a specific approved institution.
They also thought that the sudden onslaught of everyone sharing their data publicly could make things messy for researchers to comb through and find what they need.
And it was thought that switching from voluntary to mandatory data sharing might be perceived as intrusive and stir up some bad feelings among researchers.
But it was mentioned that the efforts in the US to promote public domain data have been an example of solid progress, and they praise these efforts for improving researchers' access to data that can be used to improve influenza mitigation.
Ever the optimist, Barbara.
I have to be, otherwise the world would be a sad, dark place.
What are your thoughts, listeners? Should scientists be obligated to share flu strain data? If so, who should have access? Everyone? A few select people? Share your thoughts using the hashtag ISGP forum.
The debaters felt that if data was to be openly shared, intellectual property rights would be in need of attention. Particularly, we would need better definitions for what constitutes a discovery and what constitutes an invention.
It was argued that gene sequences of a virus fall under the category of discovery because they're products of nature and the sequences can easily be rederived. However, invention was defined as a method used to create a product based on an understanding of the gene sequences.
However, the debaters felt there was work to be done regarding whether viral sequences can be owned, mostly because the person who, quote, owns it will dictate the monetary profits.
And that's not good if the person or company decides to jack up the price of a sequence because it's needed during a pandemic flu outbreak.
Perhaps then, this data sharing shouldn't just take the form of tossing it out into the wind, but rather it should be a collaboration of all parties that can help with predicting and preventing new flu outbreaks, like, say, veterinarians, environmentalists, disease experts.
That sounds like the One Health approach to me.
It is, in fact, just that.
If you, our wonderful listeners, want to know more about One Health, why not check out Episode 7, Fever Fortune Tellers?
For those of you who don't remember the details, the One Health approach is simply the theoretical establishment of a collaborative network of researchers in a variety of fields, including human, animal, and environmental health, which would bridge the gap between animal and human health in regards to disease prevention.
Dr. Capua wanted to go one step further than the One Health approach, though. She wanted to see a One Flu approach.
And what's that?
Yeah, it sounds like a narrow scope.
A One Flu approach is an international initiative to create a constant monitoring system specifically for virus evolution. Meaning, there would be continuous holistic research on emerging flu strains to help prevent future outbreaks of pandemic flus.
What did the debaters think about the one flu approach?
The debaters really liked the idea, and they saw it as a more practical implementation of what One Health is trying to do. They actually felt that One Health is too large and far-reaching, which is why there has been a lag in actually implementing it.
In fact, they liked One Flu so much, they further developed the idea.
They thought that this one flu approach should include things like epidemiological investigations performed by groups of researchers so that there's an effective assessment of risk. The data, however, should come from not only specific outbreaks, but also across multiple disease events.
Huh. I kind of like the idea of an epidemiological investigator. Detective disease.
Detective disease, he catches the flu before you do.
That's a movie I could get behind.
The debaters also said that One Flu programs need to collect sequence data and curate strains from influenza viruses currently seen in animals so scientists could better understand and actually predict how, when, and why viruses jump to humans.
The science isn't quite up to speed with that, though. Current scientific capabilities do not relate sequence data to the pathogenicity of a microbe.
And while the current focus is only on collecting and sharing sequence data, other information like immunogenicity data or the ability of a particular substance to provoke an immune response is needed.
Oh, great. Some more we know we don't knows.
Well, because of just that, it was suggested that maybe one flu should be one fill in the blank with an easier and more predictable disease here as a starting point to see if this approach even has a shot at working.
That makes sense. You have to have training wheels before you can ride a bike.
That's not entirely true. My friends just put me on a normal bike and shoved me into a busy parking lot. I learned very quickly.
I can't even tell if that's an argument for implementing the one flu approach immediately, or if I should just be happy that you're still alive.
Either way, you can pick.
Speaking of mortality, One thing the debaters felt needed to be worked on to help in the prevention and mitigation of pandemic flus is rapid vaccine distribution. During the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, the delay in vaccine distribution was very noticeable. If H1N1 had been more virulent, that could have meant serious health implications.
The debaters had a pretty big debate themselves on the development and regulation of vaccines in pandemic situations.
They felt that existing synthetic biology facilities creating egg-free vaccines at a fairly rapid pace was a good place to start. An influenza vaccine can now be created from a DNA sequence in less than 5 days in some cases.
At the time of this debate, the then recent creation of a new biosafety level 3 facility was cited as a good example of how far synthetic biology has gone in vaccine development. This plant is able to produce 100 to 150 million three-part vaccines twice a year.
That's a lot of shots.
Going back to the data sharing for a brief moment, the debaters thought that in the context of synthetic biology, data sharing could be problematic, mostly because putting all of this genetic sequencing information out there into the nethersphere could mean it could end up in the wrong hands.
Nevertheless, synthetic biology technology has not been universally implemented.
Whether or not that technology is implemented, though, the debaters felt that regulatory approval and onerous requirements associated with making sure the vaccine is up to par are massive roadblocks to getting vaccines to those who need it immediately.
Which absolutely makes sense. Vaccines are incredibly important, and the faster they can be safely put out there, the faster the virus can be contained.
Regarding the H1N1 outbreak and its vaccine, the debaters felt that the delay wasn't caused by the time needed to produce the initial strain of the vaccine, but rather the length of time it took to collectively produce the initial strain, identify production standards, make the vaccine in bulk, and then go through the regulatory process.
That is a lot of steps. No wonder there was a delay.
Here's another interesting thought brought up by the debaters about vaccines and pandemic flu situations. Today, most vaccines are created in the very large countries of India and China. The debaters were concerned that if a virulent flu came around, these countries would obviously prioritize their population over others. They can only make so many vaccines, and they have so many people.
Because of this, it was suggested that smaller countries should make vaccines. That way, even if they vaccinate every single person in their country, there is still enough to send to other countries.
Another idea that was tossed out there was having a seed vaccine library, basically a repository of flu strains which could be rapidly used in the event of a pandemic flu, so the strain can be identified faster.
Okay, so usually I'm all for hanging out in libraries. They are, in fact, my favorite place. But I am not going there. Nope, 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 nope,
nope. Wouldn't the rapid speed of the creation of synthetic biological vaccines make this library obsolete?
The debaters thought it might. But again, the synthetic biotechnology isn't implemented everywhere.
So now we know what we know. But restating what Dr. Capua said in her title, how do we apply what we know?
Well, first off, Dr. Capua thought that a permanent global repository that contains existing information on flu strains, like genetic and epidemiological info, needs to be created.
These repositories are kind of like flu superheroes, ever vigilant and ready to combat any pandemic flu that comes its way.
Well, that's not too far from the truth. Such a repository could assess currently circulating flu strains and see if they have pandemic potential. And if they do, how severe an effect that strain could have on human populations.
But this seems like it requires quite a bit of funding. What does Dr. Capua recommend about getting money?
She thought that international donors and funding agencies involved in influenza research and surveillance should make sure money is available to researchers in an equitable, ethical, and efficient manner.
Ah, so that would make incidents like the funneling of research funds into H5N1 over H1N1, which happened in 2009, non-existent.
Right.
And with all of these different groups conducting research in similar areas, Dr. Kapua thought that any databases used by different research groups to store information on flu strains should be compatible with one another. That way, if other groups need to access that information, or it's being shared between everyone like we mentioned earlier, it's understandable and accessible to all of those who need it.
The debaters had a different train of thought when thinking about what we know and how to apply it. They focused on public health infrastructure so that events like H1N1 pandemic pandemonium could be avoided in the future.
Sounds like a solid goal to achieve.
They felt that the global public health infrastructure is severely lacking, particularly in regards to vaccines. It was decided that there needs to be continuous efforts by different organizations and governmental bodies to build infrastructure in less wealthy nations that otherwise struggle to distribute vaccines.
The debaters agreed that the overall public infrastructure put into place for H5N1 and then used for H1N1 should be strengthened. They also thought that a platform should be constructed to facilitate not just the public health response to the flu, but to other diseases as well.
But I think we're missing an important part here. Remember at the beginning of this podcast, we said that because of the delay in identifying H1N1, perception of public health officials was generally bad? How can all these changes be enacted if no one believes they'll work?
Good point. Discussions seem to suggest that the right messages need to be communicated to the public at the right time. A misinformed or uninformed public is one that gets suspicious. In addition, there needs to be active communication with policymakers so that they can make informed decisions.
That makes sense, but no matter what, public health officials can't always be right. I mean, they can communicate what they know, but if something occurs randomly again, like H1N1,
it is important to remember that Dr. Kapua stated that there is still a chance researchers could be baffled by the flu again. It is, at its heart, unpredictable.
Exactly. The next pandemic flu could come from anywhere. Avian flus like H5N1 or other zoonotic flus like H9N2 are endemic to large areas of the Eastern Hemisphere.
And while we may not be able to guess correctly which flu is going to become the next pandemic flu, we can certainly prepare for every scenario and make our response time quicker when an outbreak occurs.
Absolutely. But there is something we can predict out of all of this.
What?
That our listeners, now armed with a ton of flu-related info, will mull it all over and then chat with us about it online.
Well, if that's the case, then we can prepare by manning our social media pages and making sure we're able to quickly respond and join the discussion. See what I did there? Prepare, respond, just like the flu.
Oh my goodness.
So, what are your thoughts on flu preparedness? Is it even possible for us to accurately predict every flu? Should scientists be told they must share all data? If so, with whom? And how do we implement synthetic biotechnology in more areas for rapid vaccine development?
And now that we know what we know and what we don't know, and we know what we know what to do with what we know and don't know, I think that about wraps up today's show.
Thank you for socializing with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.